space. For example, ADSQ CFT, typically the Dew theory give you a vector-like spectrum. So, and just as a side theoretical curiosity, we may also ask the question whether it's possible to define even standard model non-perturbatively on the lattice, because standard model by itself is also a chiral theory. So that was the motivation. But of course, the real motivation for me to do this, to study chiral lattice gauge theory, is really simply because we don't know how to do it. So I just give you the current situation about this business right now. It is proven that for a U1 gauge group, a chiral lattice theory exists. So that's been proved to be true. However, the proof by itself is not very useful for practical simulation because it's sort of an abstract proof. And for the non-abelian gauge groups, the very existence of it is not even known. It remains an open question. So as you can see, we are very far from having any real concrete physical model that we can simulate on lattice at this point. So unfortunately, in this talk, I will not talk about any concrete models. Instead, I will try to just tell you where the current study on chiral lattice gauge theory is at, and hopefully I can convince you, well, it's by itself, it's a theoretically appealing problem to think about. So what is our idea? It's not even our idea. The idea is sort of old. It is called so-called decoupling of mirror fermions. And why do we need such an idea, such a weird sentence? Well, because as I try to explain to you a bit later, that defining chiral gauge theory on the lattice by itself is a very difficult job. At this point, we don't even know how to do that, in fact. And it's a well-known problem right by now, and I will explain this a little bit later. But defining vector-like theory on the lattice is actually much less a problem. For example, QCD, people have done that all the time. And so the idea is simply, we call it a EP dream. It's because the first it was first studied by these two people. And so we call it EP dream. The idea is simply, suppose this is a chiral theory that I want to study on the lattice. Say if it's SU5 chiral theory. So these are the wild fermions in these representations, and these are the fermions I want to study. But to define a chiral lattice theory is difficult, so what I do is I introduce a set of fermions with opposite chiralities. They live in the conjugate representation. And so these are all wild fermions, but together, the whole sector becomes vector-like. So defining a vector-like theory like this is actually very easy. Okay, well, not very easy, but it's doable. And so the idea is, can we actually deform the theory in such a way so that by introducing interactions in the mirror sector, we can make all the mirror fermions heavy. If we are able to do that, and then at a low energy limit, I automatically get the chiral theory out of it. Okay? So the point is we have to make the mirror decouple from the low energy spectrum by making them heavy. And at the same time, I better make sure that gauge symmetry remains unbroken, because in the end, what I want is a chiral gauge theory. So I want to make sure the gauge symmetry is not broken in this limit. And so in two theories in the continuum, usually this is very difficult, almost impossible, because typically what happens when the mirror fermions get integrated out of your spectrum, some sort of Higgs mechanism will be at work, and you will spontaneously break the gauge symmetry. But on the lattice, this becomes possible because there is a so-called strong coupling symmetrical phase on the lattice. Okay, for example, a four fermion interactions like this, and everyone knows that if the coupling is strong enough, the theory will spontaneously break chiral symmetry. That's just, you know, given by this so-called NJL gap equation and so on. But not everyone knows that if we take the coupling even stronger, on the lattice, the theory eventually will enter a phase called strong coupling symmetrical phase, where even though all the excitations are massive, the ground state does not break chiral symmetry. And these phases are usually it's called lattice artifact because they only exist on the lattice, because the excitations are heavier even than the UV cutoff of the theory. So it won't make sense in the continuum limit. And they are better studied using strong coupling expansion, which has the advantage that it's a real series expansion, so it has a convergence, radius of convergence. And another advantage of strong coupling expansion is that it's applicable in any dimension. It's insensitive to the spatial dimensions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what happens if you take the continuum limit, you end up with nothing. Okay. Everything is heavy and cut off. So if you take the continuum limit, they are all integrated out, but you have no dynamic of the degree freedom at all. Okay. So you end up with nothing. So it's a trivial view.
You have Gn greater than 8 pi squared. What about lambda? Must be some... what about constraint of lambda?
What do you mean lambda? You mean a torque coupling?
Yeah. Kappa lambda.
Oh, capital lambda, I'm sorry. Yeah, capital lambda... No, it's insensitive to that. Hmm? It's just a cutoff of the theory. It's insensitive to that. Okay, it's because it's a non-renormalizable, non-renormalized for terms, so you have to have a cutoff. That's
what is N?
N, I believe, is just the rank of the group. Yeah. The rank of the color. Yeah, okay. I just gave this an example, it's not main focus on the part. But okay, so another example for this for the strong coupling symmetrical phase is, for example, if I have SU4 chirosymmetry, which is simpler than the so-called EPGM where you start SU5T. Okay, for SU4, you can introduce a four Fermi interaction on the lattice. This is a Hamiltonian analysis. So this X labels a spatial lattice site. And so you introduce an interaction like this. There's a localized interaction, and then there's a kinetic term, as usual. And then you do the canonical quantization, as usual. But on the lattice, what you can do is you can take the couplings large enough so that you can treat the interaction as a non-perturbed Hamiltonian and treat the kinetic term as the perturbation of the Hamiltonian. In that case, because the interaction is a localized interaction, it's very easily diagonalized, okay? So if you just introduce the annihilation creation operator, you get something like this, and it's very easily diagonalized because it's a localized object. On each local lattice site, where you have just 16 states, in terms of the SU4 representations, you have 1 prime, and 4 star, and 6. So 1 and 1 prime are the states, are the singlets, 1 corresponding to 0 occupation, and 1 prime correspond to 4 occupations. Okay? And the spectrum, and it's very easy to check that this interaction only couples one and one, only connect one and one prime state. And so they only introduce a splitting between these two states. So if you diagonalize the Hamiltonian, it's very easily worked out. And the ground state is given by this state, and there is a mass gap between the ground state and the first excitation, which is given by this coupling gene. Okay, and you can see there is a unique ground state with a mass gap, and the ground state is a singlet of SU4. With a little bit more technicalities, you can convince yourself that when you turn on a kinetic term and even dynamical gate field, as long as the coupling is strong enough, the ground state analysis remains the lead. So the idea is essentially the same thing can be repeated for SU5, except there you have to introduce additional singlet. And you have to introduce two interacting terms like this to break all the global symmetries. And then the same conclusions can be reached there. So the idea of so-called decoupling of mirror fermion is essentially to use this phase to decouple all the mirror fermions. As I said, on the lattice, what happens is they are all heavy, and you'll be cut off. When you take the continuum limit, they just completely disappear in your spectrum. And that's precisely what we want. Usually, strong coupling symmetrical phase is not very interesting at all, because if you take the continuum limit, you get nothing. But for our purpose, it's precisely what we hope to happen. Okay? So another example is for the so-called gauge XY model. It's simply a unitary Higgs field. So there's a field that's a unitary, so there's a phase of it. So that's the only degree of freedom, which is the phase, and minimally coupled to U1 gauge theory. And that is also known when the kappa here, because the kappa is in front of the kinetic term, so small kappa actually correspond to strong coupling dynamics. When kappa is very small, the theory is also in a strong coupling symmetrical phase.
Can I ask a sort of, say, orthogonal question? So okay. In the case where I do have a continuum field theory, can I also just give a short Fermilab coupling and then have some kernel symmetry breaking and then just say sort of say keep only part of the same chiral spectrum in
no.
a vector like
no, 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 you won't, because you just get the vacuum the break chiral symmetry, but the excitations are still vector like. Right?
So you I see? Never in
no.
in
QCD, for example, even though the vacuum break chiral symmetry, but the excitations, the propagating degree freedom is still vector. You still have the full vector.
So let me try to understand. So the mechanism that you said only applies on the lattice, but
that's right. It's a lattice artifact. But the thing is, the difficulty by itself is also only on lattice. There's no difficulty defining chiral theory in the continuum, so you don't bother doing that. But on the lattice, you have this difficulty. And but then accidentally on the lattice, you also have this strong coupling symmetrical phase. So the hope is to take advantage of that. So then there's also in this model, it's also known when kappa is very small, you have a strong coupling symmetrical phase. In the sense that the unitary Higgs field phi here is heavy, and you end up with nothing but a simple U1 gauge theory. Okay, so this is just some numerical simulation we have done, and I don't want to bother describing this to you in this talk, but just to mention that when kappa is above and below one, you can see clearly a transition, a phase transition here. So this piece can be identified with a pure U1 gauge theory on the lattice with no additional propagating degree freedom. Okay, so now I convince you that on the lattice this seems to be possible. So why wasn't this problem solved a long time ago? And the reason was before 1990s, it was not known how to define exact chiral fermions on the lattice, because there was no exact chiral symmetry on the lattice, which I will explain a little bit more on this later. But after 1990, people, after this paper, Ginsburg, Wilson, Nyberger, Lucia, and many people, it was gradually understood that in fact, there is exact chiral symmetry that can be defined on the lattice, although it's sort of a weird chiral symmetry. I try to talk about a little bit later. And so with that chiral symmetry, you can in fact define left and right-handed component of a Dirac spinner, which is usually called overlap chiral fermions. And it's been proven by Lucia that a U1 chiral gate theory is possible to be defined on the lattice. And so then the natural question right now is, can we now use these overlap chiral fermions to realize this EG dream on the lattice? So that one was studied by Joe and Eric a while ago. And they started a much simpler toy model called the zero-one model. It's a 2D theory with U1 gate. Well, what they have done is actually on the zero gate field background, but the hope is to do the dynamics, the whole theory with the U1 gate field. And they use overlap fermions, but the theory has, it is called zero-one model because we have a pair of Dirac fermions named Psi and Chi here. Psi is charged 1 and chi is charged 0. Okay? So it's a pair of Dirac fermions. And this plus minus sign here just denotes the chiral component of it. However, this chiral component of this Dirac spinner is not a usual wire spinner anymore. It's on the lattice, it's called the overlap fermions. Okay? But disregarding this subtlety here, so what you have is the action can be separated into a light part and a mirror part. There's also plus S kappa. Three of these. You have a light part and a mirror part. The light part is simply a two connected term for two free chiral fermions. And that's precisely what we hope to retain in the end of the story. And in the mirror part, besides the usual connected term of the fermions with the opposite chirality, you also introduce a bunch of interactions. So there's a Yukawa coupling and there's a Majorana type Yukawa couplings. And so you have two coefficients, Y and H, in front of you. So when these coefficients are large, you have a strong couple dynamics in the mirror sector. And in order for Yukawa couplings to be possible, you have to introduce additional scalar because we have different charges. And so the additional scalar is, as again, a unitary Higgs field, as I mentioned to you in the gauge XR model. And so everything, this is just, again, the normal connected term for phi. Okay? What they did is the numerical simulation, and I don't want to explain the details of this plot, but just take my word for it, if you don't mind, that when they found, if they take the coupling Y and H large enough, so for Y is very large, but H just has to be about 1, they find all the chiral, all the mirror fermions, mainly the fermions in the mirror sector is fermions that has the wrong chirality are heavy, and also the unitary Higgs field are heavy. Okay. So this is just the evidence for that, but let me just skip over it. So the situation right now seems like we have already achieved our goal, because if really, indeed, all the fields in the mirror part are heavy, then at the low energy, we should automatically get a chiral dynamics out of for this field, okay, which is only contained in light content. But are we really sure about that? Two questions has to be answered. First of all, are we really sure that the entire mirror sector is heavy? Even though what they have studied is that they simulate the mass, lower bound for the mass of the charged fermion and unitary Higgs field, everything in the mirror sector seems to be heavy. But in principle, there can be infinitely many different composite states of these fundamental degree splits. And you can never exhaustively examine everything. So you don't really know if the mirror sector is all heavy. And even another question is that whether the mirror sector is actually unitary in the continuum limit. And we have reasons that these two conditions cannot be satisfied simultaneously. And the reason for that is if you look at the light content, you see the fermion content in the light sector is actually anomalous. And so is the mirror sector, because the whole theory is vector-like, so it's never anomalous. But now we're splitting the whole vector-like theory into two sectors, and both sectors are anomalous, right? Because you have a charge 1 chiral fermion and charge 0 chiral fermion. So the theory cannot make sense if you turn on the four dynamics. If it's a four gate theory, it will not make sense at all. So something has to go wrong. One of these two should break in the continuum limit. Okay? So in order to answer the question, which one of these two is wrong, I need to, now I have to take a little bit detour to explain a little bit the theoretical aspect, the technicalities of this business. I try to be as brief as possible, but I have to mention a bit of it. So I kept telling you that defining chiral theory on the lattice in a straightforward way is difficult. And why is that? It is because there's a well-known problem, I guess by now, and most people have at least have heard of it once or twice, that there is a fermion doubling issue on the lattice. Namely, if you just naively discretize the direct operator, and even you put on a single wire fermion on the lattice, and then you take the continuum limit, you always get the species of the fermion double. Always you get, even if you put a left-handed wire fermion on the lattice, and then you take the continuum limit, you always get the right-handed wire fermion automatically out of the spectrum. Okay. I won't have time to explain this to you, but it's really because the angular momentum, once you put on the lattice, become angular. The momentum, once you put out the theory on the lattice, the momentum variable becomes an angular variable, so it has a period. It becomes a periodic. So the propagator becomes a periodic function of it, and therefore, not only you can expand the propagator at small momentum here, you can also expand the propagator at large momentum near momentum equals pi. So anyway, so just take my word for it. There's a fermion doubling issue if you just naively discretize the direct operator. And so what's realized later by people that the only way to get away from the doublets is to explicitly break chiral symmetry on the lattice somewhat. And so for example, Ginsburg-Wilson in 1982 proposed a solution to the problem by introducing the so-called Ginsburg-Wilson operator V, which doesn't intercommute with gamma phi. If it intercommute with gamma phi, then the theory will respect chiral symmetry exactly. So you have to break the chiral symmetry slightly by introducing additional term on this side of the equation. So A here is just the lattice spacing. In our convention, we will set it to be 1. And so this part, break current symmetry spacing. And you also want the operator to become a fine condition, as the usual Dirac operator. So in the continuum limit, which is corresponding to small momentum limit, because this operator is some derivative operator, it's proportional to the momentum. So in the continuum limit, you see this part is smaller compared to this. So you can drop this piece, and you recover the usual anti-commutator relation between Dirac operator and gamma phi. But on the lattice, it's broken slightly. And use this so-called Ginsburg-Wilson operator, you can prove that indeed you can get rid of the Douglas. Now you make the Douglas happen. Okay. Instead of having the circle sitting right here, now the circle is shifted to here, and the Douglas lives here, which has a very large eigenvalue. Corresponding. Okay, so just take my word for that. Using the Ginsburg-Wilson operator, you do get away from the Douglas. But then, of course, as I said, you do explicitly break Carroll symmetry. That's bad, because now you cannot define a Carroll theory on the lattice. But then it was discovered that indeed there is a way to recover Carroll symmetry, although it's a little bit strange, but it's a very funny way. The way out is to introduce a new gamma phi. It is almost the same as the usual gamma phi. However, it differs by a factor 1 minus dt. Again, if you take the continuum limit, this is momentum, which is very small compared to 1. So you get the usual gamma phi. But on the lattice, it's slightly different from gamma phi. However, the Ginsburg-Wilson relations, the two Ginsburg-Wilson relations, this piece and this piece, in fact, guarantees that these two conditions are satisfied. So gamma phi has squared to be 1, just as the usual gamma phi. And also almost anti-commute with D, except when it passes through the operator D, it becomes the usual gamma phi, and vice versa. Okay? So these two properties are very interesting, because this property tells you that there is a way to recover Carroll symmetry on the lattice. For example, if I have a Dirac spinner, and I write on a connected term in the usual way, except here, I put a Ginsburg-Wilson operator D. Then you can easily check that the action is invariant under these rotations. Okay? So it's almost the same rotation as usual. For this guy, it's the usual rotation, axial rotation. But for bar spin, for Psi bar, you rotate it with gamma phi hat. So due to this relation, it's easily checked that the action is indeed invariant. And the fact that gamma phi hat exactly squared to be 1 tells you that there is a way to define a new type of chiral spinner, which we call overlap chiral firmness. By using the projection operators defined this way. So this is the normal projection operator using the normal gamma phi matrix for psi. Okay? For psi, you just project it the same way as usual, and that's the chiral spinners you have. However, for psi bar, you use a slightly different chiral projection, which is defined through gamma phi hat. If you use that, you cannot define chiral theory on the lattice using these chiral components. It looks almost the same as the usual wire firmness. This is just the usual wire firmness, but this is slightly different because I'm using a slightly different gamma phi matrix when I do the projection. Okay? So that's the way you recover chiral symmetry on the lattice. It's not quite the same chiral symmetry anymore, but in the continuum limit, you get the same thing. And it is an exact symmetry on the lattice, so it has all the advantages. For example, you can rigorously prove lattice index theorem, you can rigorously derive the Gibbs anomaly equation on the lattice, and so on. There's lots of very good, fascinating theoretical consequences of it. But it doesn't really solve the problem, because the moment you turn out dynamical gauge view, you end up with a very messy situation again. And the reason for that is because when you have dynamical gauge view, defining the fermion measure becomes ambiguous. Okay? And why is that so? It is because once you turn out dynamical gauge view, the Ginsburg-Wilson operator has to be covariantized, just like the usual Dirac operator. Becomes a covariant derivative, and therefore it depends on the gauge view back, and that's not anything surprising. But what's really bad is that gamma phi hat and p hat because gamma phi hat is defined this way, so it depends on installation operator D. Therefore, when you have the dynamical gate field, gamma phi hat and P hat depends on the gate field diagram as well. When you change the gate field diagram, it changes a little bit. Okay, gamma phi hat and P hat are not the same. And that's really the core of the difficulties of defining parallel gate theory. Okay, so to understand why this is bad, let me just start with a most general formulation for the chiral action on the lattice. So a action as is said to be chiral on the lattice simply means it only depends on part of the chiral firmness, not the full direct spinner, but only the overlap chiral components. Which means if you stick to a projection operator in front of your field, the action should be invalid. Right? That's precisely what the action being chiral means. It just means it only depends on a particular chiral component of the spinner. So here, of course, I ignore plus minus here. Just assume I choose the appropriate one. But anyway, the fact that the action being chiral means it only depends on part of the spinner, not for the direct spinner, but only half of the components. So if I stick to in a projection operator, I guess I'll be invariant, right? So that's the basic defining property of the action being chiral. So how do you define a partition function? The partition function has to be a Grassmann integral. And in order to do that, you have to extend your thinness by a set of orthonormal bases. So I call it U and these. The orthonormal bases extend the chiral spinning for you. So therefore, they have to be the eigenvalues of the corresponding projection operators, right? So for U, it's just a normal Y of firmness. So it's the eigenvector of the normal projection operator. But for V, for these R spinners, because I'm using a slightly different projection operator, so it's a right eigenvector of P hat, okay? Not the usual P, but P hat. And then you just carry out a Grassmann integral like this. You extend your spinness in terms of the vectors, and the coefficient C and C bar are Grassmann numbers, and you carry on partition integration. So this is all very nice. Except if you stare at this quantity, you find that this quantity is not well defined. I'm sorry?
It's bizarre because the U and the V are no longer on orthonormal basis.
No, they are.
That's
precisely the problem.
The measure is not the one you
need. That's precisely. Because these are orthonormal bases by themselves, but they are not orthogonal to each other.
Yeah,
yeah, precisely. That's why the partition function is not well defined. Okay? The reason is because now they are completely independent two orthonormal bases, and therefore there is always always freedom of changing different vector bases for one of them. For example, you can just rotate these. Suppose I rotate these by a unitary matrix. I define a new orthonormal basis called V prime, and then you find you do the same path integral. You find the new partition function differs from the old one by a factor given by the determinant of U. Okay.
Adding some determinants of some scalar products or, you know, as you know?
I don't know anymore. I don't know. Okay. How do you do that? By introducing additional scalars?
Well, I mean, clearly the measure, if you have a non-orthogonal basis, then
that's right.
There should be a, okay, maybe you can use technical.
Yeah.
There should be a determinant factor, right, which
yes,
yeah, so an extra measure factor, which is like the determinant of the metric.
Yeah. But that's the thing is, there's no unique way to choose what determinant. Okay. Mm-hmm. You don't know which one is really the fundamental one. There's no way to define a unique partition, whether this one is or this one is. Okay, you can introduce any determinant you want, but
in the measure. But okay, so that is okay.
You just don't. Yeah, I have thought about this for quite a while. Okay. I just realized there is no invariant, unique, natural way to define. Okay, this ambiguity is always there.
So that in the usual path integral formalism, the measure has to retain the symmetry, the chiral symmetry, so it doesn't anymore when you do this.
No. The partition function normally it doesn't have to retain the chiral symmetry because you do have the anomalies. You do want to recover the anomaly, the continuous limit. So you don't require your partition function to maintain all the chiral symmetries. You want to have you want your imposition function to maintain precisely the Chiral anomalies you want. And that's automatically done as long as you choose an orthonormal basis like that, and it's independent to the ambiguity of the phase.
And you obviously don't maintain the same measure, is what you're saying.
No.
When you test the problem.
No, you don't have the same measure, but you have the same anomaly. You choose different measure, and then you vary the action, vary the partition function, you get the same anomaly. But the partition function by itself still has the phase ambiguity.
Okay. If you multiply the measure by something like the determinant of the scalar.
But then it's not the Chiral theories you want anymore. That means you introduce additional Chiral spinner that precisely has opposite chirality. If you raise the determinant to the exponential, you just basically can write down as a light degree a free term, right? The determinant of something can always be written as a single, as a path integral of a single free term.
Then you recover.
Then you get a vector.
And they are light also, they are not massive.
Because it's a free term, so it's massless.
Okay.
Yeah, a determinant is always corresponding to some light terms. The determinant of this, this is going to be some determinant of the Ginsburg Wilson operator D. It's just a light, single light term. Yeah, you get that light. So that's the center, that's the really the essence of these problems. Usually it's not a problem actually. This is actually true in any kind of theory. In any theory of this Chiral, the partition function is always ambiguous up to a phase. Okay? Because even for the wire fermions, for the normal wire fermion, you also have the freedom to choose different orthonormal bases, and it's always ambiguous up to a phase. But it's usually not a problem. Because it's just a constant phase of the partition function, and you don't really care because it's not going to enter your physical variables, right? Your partition function is ambiguous up to a constant phase. So what? It's not a big deal.
Is it a constant phase, or is it dependent on the connection?
Precisely, that's precisely the big key. For the usual Chiral fermions, it's a constant because there's no gauge dependency. Precisely. Once you go on into the Ginsburg-Wilson formalism, as you already seen, it's going to be a real problem because the Ginsburg-Wilson operator, this p hat depends on the gauge field. And so the ambiguous phase becomes phase gauge field dependent. And that's really a problem. That's going to be a real problem. Because now your partition function seems to depend on gauge field with an arbitrary phase that can depend on gauge field in an arbitrary way. So that, of course, is going to be bad. But for U1 theory, this problem is actually in principle solved. And how is this problem solved? It's probably a proper time to introduce you the so-called splitting theorem that we like very much. It's a very simple theorem, but it seems to be very powerful and useful. And so again, as the actions, I start with the Chiral action written, which satisfies this property. Okay, and let me ignore the ambiguity at the moment. Just choose a set of orthonormal bases, U at least, and define my partition function this way. We just want to study its variation. So suppose I forgot to mention to you. So this O that appears in the action just collectively denote any operator, local operators theory happen to depend on. Okay? In your theory, you might have any kind of local operators. And that O just represents these operators. And this spinner per se also, even though I only put a single spinner here, it collectively represent multiple spinners if you do have. Okay? You can have many players with it. But anyway, let me just study the variation of the partition function by varying the orthonormal basis and also vary the operator O. Given these two properties, it's quite easy to verify that the variation of the log Z can always split into three pieces. The two pieces are given only by the variation of the vectors, and they're completely independent to the form of your action. And the last piece here, this quantity inside the brackets, really just denote the variation of the action with respect to the operators only, okay, without changing the vectors. And the angular brackets here just means the variable. And you can convince yourself with a little bit algebra. You can convince yourself that this piece turns out to be completely independent to the choice of the to the ambiguous phase. Okay, So you can choose different Vs, but that will not change this quantity. So this quantity is well defined for any chiral partition function. And these two pieces, of course, depends on the vector choices. But as I said, this U is just a usual Weyl fermion. There's no reason to vary it. So let's just not vary this piece. So it's just zero. But I do have to vary these, because when I change dynamical gauge view, when I change my gauge view, I have to change my projection operator. So I do have to change my Vs. So these do vary. Okay? So this piece can never be set to zero. Well, not can never be set to zero, but naturally it will not be zero. Okay? So this piece completely captures the ambiguity of the phase. The ambiguity of defining the partition function, all the information really is contained here. And this piece is completely independent. And this one usually is denoted as so-called J, and this is called the measure current. It is called measure because it's current, because it really captures the ambiguity of defining the fermion measure in your chiral partition function. So this J is is the magical object. It can be considered as a current on the gauge field configuration space. And obviously, it depends on the choice of your orthonormal basis. Okay? So it's not an invariant quantity. It depends on your choice. And so it captures all the ambiguity, which might be slightly surprising to you. It was to me, at least, that even though J is choice dependent, the quantity defined this way, which is like the curvature of the usual current, this quantity turns out to be orthonormal basis independent, because it can be written as a trace of the operators that's completely independent to the choice of your Vs. Okay, this is really a magical result, and then all the funny thing about Ginsburg-Wilson operator is realized by studying this quantity. And I don't have time to go into the details of it, but the upshot is that Lucia has proved, by studying that quantity, essentially integrate out the quantity over non-trivial cycles in the gauge configuration space, you find sometimes it's non-zero. If it's non-zero, you find that looks like there's a monopole inside, and so there's no way to define J smoothly. But anyway, the conclusion is, so the conclusion is that Lucia proved for us that J mu can be chosen uniquely as a smooth function, smooth current over the entire gauge field configuration space only when the normally free condition is satisfied. In this case, when J mu can have a natural, so that's the case when J mu has a natural choice. Okay, that's the way we naturally identify what's the right phase of defining this orthonormal basis. Essentially, you have two requirements by choosing this phase ambiguous phase. First of all, you want to make sure your partition function is gauge invariant, because otherwise you don't get a gauge. Second of all, of course, you want to make sure your partition function is a smooth function of your gauge field. And the two conditions, in fact, clash with each other, and they can be satisfied simultaneously only when the fermion content is normally free. But that's only proven for the U1 gauge group, unfortunately. So for the non-abelian gauge group, this problem still remains open. We still don't know whether there's a natural, unique way of defining this ambiguous space or not. Although, my personal, well, I don't know. It's still open at this point.
So the statement is that, you're looking whether you can define this G mu or?
Yeah. Essentially, you're looking for if you can define the VIs naturally, the orthonormal basis naturally. Mm-hmm. It's orthonormal basis naturally. But that's equivalent to say if you can define using the splitting theorem, it's equivalent to say whether you can find a way to define the current over the entire gauge field configuration space, mm-hmm. which satisfies two properties. First of all, it has to be smooth over the entire space. Secondly, it has to vanish along pure gauge transformations, because you want this guy to be gauge invariant. Mm-hmm. this quantity can be put into the gating element. Oh, so this quantity has to vanish when you do phase translation. And these two properties can only be satisfied simultaneously if and only if the Fermi content is a nominator. Okay. That's only be proven for your case.
Oh, okay. And people suspect it's true in general in the nominator?
I don't know. I think the impression I get is people assume so. Okay. Even though I don't know that they have any good reason for it. But my impression is that indeed people assume that is the case. Because they have started to try to construct chiral theory in this formalism or even standard model. So I guess they assume that it's true. But okay. Anyway, so combine the Lucius proof, which is for the current J, and our splitting theory, we can prove the gate invariance of the general chiral partition function and smoothness of general chiral partition function, and so on. But I don't want to go through the features of it. So let me just go to the conclusion, not the conclusion of the whole talk, sorry, but the conclusion of this part is that combining Lucius proof and our splitting theory, we can prove that if you start with a vector like theory, and you can split your partition function log z into a light part and a mirror part, only in a smooth fashion, only if both sectors are anomaly free.
What do you mean by smooth?
Smooth means it's smooth in the entire gate field of the gray space. When you vary gate field, nothing becomes singular. The two guys are also smooth. Of course, the whole thing is always smooth because the whole thing is vector like. So the full partition function is always smooth. So the question is whether you can separate into two smooth functions like this. And that's only true if both sectors are non-free. So for the 0-1 model, started by Julian and Eric before, obviously do not satisfy this property. And therefore, if you have dynamical gate field, the splitting will always become singular if you have dynamical gate field. But however, as I don't have time to tell you, but I did mention, I guess, at least once, that this obstacle is a topological obstacle. It has something to do with the topology of the gate field configuration space. Okay? So even though it cannot be chosen smoothly in the entire gate field configuration space, locally you can always make it smooth. Okay? By local here, I mean local in the gate field configuration space. Okay? You can always make it smooth because you can always tune the boundary condition so you can move the singularities away from yourself, from your neighbor. Okay? That you can always do. You can choose to move these singularities almost anywhere you want, although you cannot get rid of it. This is just like the situation where you have a magnetic monopole, then you always have a direct string, but you can move the direct string anywhere you want. And so that's all very similar here. Therefore, at the zero gate field background, near the zero gate field background, Jill and Eric started on the 0-1 model. In fact, it remains to be a correct study. Even though if you have full dynamic gate field, eventually it will hit singularity somewhere. But as long as you remain at the zero gate field configuration space, and the neighborhood of the zero gate field configuration space, the findings there are still correct.
So these statements here are precisely the same as we know from the continuum theory. It means that they're really the same statements as what we know from the continuum theory.
What is the continuum statement in continuum?
Where we know that for an anomalous ticket. Anomalous chiral gate theory, the partition function, the partition function for the theory after we integrate out the fermions is now a globally so well defined function over the gate field configuration, but three transforms.
You don't have a global section. That's right. Oh. Yeah, I think that's the same. I think that's the same.
I just want to clarify some confusion here. In the standard model, the clock sector is anomaly free because it's non chiral. the weak interaction sectors are between all the representations that are real. So you never have any anomalies in the standard model for the normalized and continuum theory. It's guaranteed. So here you have this problem of chiral the anomaly cancellation. So see why you're getting into a lot of problems by doing this discretization.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
What are you gaining from all this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the gaining is if you want to study strong coupled dynamics, if it's a strong coupled chiral field, you have to find some way to regularize it. And the latter seems to be, at least for the simple-minded people, it is the way out.
But this is not the only way to regularize.
Yeah, of course, yes.
You're getting into a lot of problems.
I know, yes.
You're getting more trouble than it's worth.
Yes, yes. Although, okay, that's true. It's a fair criticism. But if the problem is indeed, at least for to a simple-minded people like me, I will first thought that lattice regularization would be easy. And then it becomes surprising that it's not. At least that's my experience with it. And maybe there's something deep in there.
And this has been a problem for years.
Yes. But the Hinsberg-Wilson formula is only recently studied. Right? The fermion doubling problem has been a problem for years. But in the 1990s, people discovered this Hinsberg-Wilson formula. And so all of a sudden, people got excited. Maybe now this problem can be solved. And now we're saying that this problem really hasn't been solved. So, I apologize for the unsatisfactory.
So, I have a question which may be technical. As far as I understand, maybe this condition of smoothness over the whole configuration field of gauge field in the discrete is maybe too much. Because when you take the continuum, as far as I understand, when you take the continuum into space, what you get is that you're going to get all possible different topological sectors.
That's right. I was being. Okay, because I did not expect people to raise that point. I was being very crude about this so-called entire gauge configuration.
Yeah.
It's not entire gauge configuration. It's the permissible gauge configuration changing space when you take a continuum limit. So it is a real problem. It's not the entire.
So it's not index 0 or 1.
Only in one particular sector that do survive in the continuum limit. Already there is a problem. Okay. That's what Rich is thinking. It's not for the whole thing. Which is, as you said, precisely too much. Yes. Okay, but these are just, okay, now let me come back in the last 10 minutes, let me come back to the 0-1 model. As I said, because I have anomalous light mirror, I have anomalous mirror sector, and if it was found that all the fermions seem to be heavy there, and also the unitary Higgs field seems to be heavy there, then it looks like we do get a light anomaly theory in the end. So that looks like somehow a paradox. And this is, there is one way to see why it is a paradox. Let's just study. So let's focus on the mirror sect only. So this partition function now only denotes a partition function for the mirror sect. So let's look at the photon polarization operator defined as usual, which is the second derivative of your log z with respect to the gauge field A. Usually, this quantity is well defined in the continuum theory. But on the lattice system, not, because as I explained to you already, there's a measure ambiguity. So there's a current coming out. This is the measure current. Okay, to derive this quantity, we have to use our splitting theorem, and then there is a current coming out. Okay? And then this piece can be written in this fashion, where O here represents a complicated local operator, which can be computed exactly. And it can be verified, this quantity is gauge invariant. So this piece is the ambiguous piece. But we don't really care about this in our situation, because the whole theory is vector-like. So in the end, this guy is just going to be canceled by the counterpart in the light sector. Okay. So this piece we can drop it. We don't really care about this. We can focus only on this piece. And this piece is not automatically symmetrized. So we have to symmetrize this piece and so on. But anyway, after we've done all the calculations, we find that you can exactly calculate the divergence of this piece, the symmetrical piece of the photon polarization operator for the mirror sector. You can compute its divergence which is complete, which can be computed exactly, and it would be given by this fraction, by this formula. And this gamma phi hat is the usual, the gamma, oh, why am I raised this to to here? It's really the gamma phi should be here, down here. It's the normal gamma phi hat I already introduced to you 10 minutes ago. The point is, this is precisely the correct anomaly equation on the lattice. But the point is, if you take k small, take the continuum limit, namely k goes to zero limit, this one can be computed exactly to be given by this formula, where epsilon mu mu is precise, is just the normal epsilon tensor, and this is in the momentum space. So that's exactly true when k is nearly zero. So here is the now comes the paradox, because to solve this equation at this k near zero limit, it's very easy. In fact, the only solution to this equation, a normal equation, is given by this usual fraction. Oh, sorry, again, I should mention, everything is in 2D this model. Okay, it's a 2D dimension, two-dimensional model, just for simplicity. But the similar question, thing can be said for 4D, except there you have to study four-time three-point functions, not two-point functions. But everything else actually is then identically the same. But 2D just happened to be simpler. For this equation, you can solve it, and you find the only solution is given by this thing. Of course, there can be any divergent three piece, because this one is only the divergence, so it doesn't determine any divergent three piece. But at least for the imaginary piece of this guy, which is non-transversal, that's the only solution. Okay, if you look at this solution, you find there's a massless pole, right? So that indicates indeed there is a light degree freedom that coupled to the photon, coupled to the U1 gate thing. But that's not defined in Joe and Eric's numerical simulation. So that is where that is the paradox of the whole thing. Okay? Of course, to a suspicious people, a person, you might ask, well, how much is this really enough? Is this a strong enough evidence to say that there is a light degree freedom that couples to the photon? Because after all, this piece comes from the anomaly. And we know the fourth theory is vector-like, and there's no anomaly. So this piece eventually will be canceled by the piece that comes from the light sector. The light sector, remember, is also anomalous. We also contain a piece like this. So the whole thing will actually cancel it out in the end. And so you might think this might just be an artifact due to the fact that you are splitting a vector-like theory into two anomalous sectors. And then you get something like this, which maybe doesn't mean anything. But this is not true if you assume that the mirror sector is indeed unitary if you take the continuum limit. And if you do assume that the mirror sector is unitary in the continuum limit, you can prove indeed indeed there is a light degree freedom, which I don't want to go to the details here, but it's very easy to prove it. The conclusion is this: if the theory is really unitary, then the photon polarization operator in 2D can always be written in this fashion. And this one is the anomaly, anomalous piece. And this one is precisely the usual, the real part of this piece. It's normal, is the normal contribution due to any particles in the spectrum. And the conclusion is, if B is non-zero, A has to be non-zero, and has to be larger than twice of the absolute value of B. That's just given by the unitarity. If you're assuming unitarity, then you can easily prove this. And therefore, it means as long as this guy is non-zero, if there is an anomalous piece here, you have to have a light degree freedom in the real part of the photon polarization rate. And of course, this is not any surprising, and this is always true in the continuum limit. I just mentioned a free fermion precisely saturates this bound, a free wild fermion precisely saturates this bound. Okay? So that's the paradox. So there are only two ways to solve this paradox. Either the theory is not unitary in the continuum limit, which is of course very bad. That also kills the model. Or the theory does contain a light degree freedom in the mirror sector. It just has not been discovered by Joe and Eric. And if it's not discovered by Joe and Eric, it has to be a non-local composite state of the fundamental degree freedom. Okay? We have some clue why, what kind of non-local composite state is. But I don't have time to go there. So either one of them has to be true. So how do we tell which one is true? At this point, we have to go back to numerical simulations because we don't have the power to compute everything analytically. But even to do the numerical simulation, the splitting theorem and the theoretical development we have done in our previous paper are proven to be very important, because you really have to compute the exact quantities inside this angular bracket. So I don't want to describe these technicalities to you, but just the photon polarization operator can be separated into the three pieces, and we have lots of operators inside. And these angular brackets, again, just denote the vacuum expectation value of the everything inside. So we have to do a lot of analytic computations to compute everything inside the angular bracket. And you end up with a quite messy, complicated expression. But in the end, once we have every operator computed inside the angular bracket, we still have to put it onto a computer to simulate the vacuum expectation value. Okay, and that's what we did. We use a CITAS supercomputer called Sunny Vale, and I try to steal usually 400 CPUs as much whenever I can. And even with 400 CPUs, it takes like 5 or 6 hours to do a single simulation. But why is that? It's actually a kind of stupid reason. It's just because these quantities happen to have lots of momentum summation inside. It has a 6 momentum summation on an 8x8 lattice. For each summation, it's 64. You have to sum 64 times, right? You have 6 momentum summation. It means you have 64 to the 6th order summations, which is really a huge summation. 8x8 is just the maximum we can do. We cannot do 16x6, and 4x4 is too small.
Yeah,
okay. 4x4 is doesn't look any nice, it's too small. And 16x16 is what we really hope to get, but we need a much larger computer. So 8x8 is what we can do. So before I tell you, finally, before I tell you the numerical result, let me just explain to you how do we try to distinguish the two scenarios on 8x8 lattice. What we do is we look for the angular singularity of the photon polarization operator. Remember, the photon if there is a massless pole, the real part of the photon polarization operator is given by this expression. Okay, and on 2D, I can use polar coordinates, write on my momenta in this fashion. So this is just the polar coordinate. For example, I'm looking at pi 0, 0. I'm looking at the real part of it. It's just given by this guy. And it turns out to be independent to the modulus of the momenta, which is not very surprising. It only depends on the direction of the momenta. Okay? So therefore, it means if you're approaching zero momentum limit from different directions, you will get different results. Okay, for example, if you're approaching it from 0 degrees, you get 0. From 45 degrees, you get -1/2. Or from 90 degrees, you get -1. So near here, you should see an order 1 difference if you're approaching 0 momentum limit from different directions. So that indication that really there is a light massless problem. On the other hand, if there is no massless problem, then this guy should approach 0 when you approach 0 momentum limit. And so you see all the 3 lines converge to 0 when momentum is small. Okay, that's the signature if there's no massless degree. These two diagrams is plotted by Mathematica and is only for a single massless free fermion. For a single massless free fermion in Ginsburg-Wilson formalism, we can compute everything analytically and exactly. So we can use Mathematica to plot it. Okay? So now we want to numerically simulate the mirror sector, and that's the final result. And you see this part is the mirror sector, and this is the single free fermion, massless fermion by Mathematica. Forget about this point, because zero momentum point is boundary conditions sensitive, so it doesn't have any physical meaning. But forget about this piece, you see these two diagrams look identical to each other. Okay, they're almost identical. You're approaching zero momentum limit from 0, and 45 and 90 degrees, this one. And you indeed see when the momentum is small, you see another difference, another one difference. By small, on A by A lattice, it means momentum is one, okay? You cannot go below one. So that's why we have to use A by A. 4 by 4 really doesn't look nice, look smooth at all. And A and 16, I cannot do. Okay? So we think this is a very strong evidence that really there is a light degree freedom coupled to U1 photon in the mirror sector, even though it's not been discovered by Jill and Eric. And we have some clue about what this light fermion should be. It must be a non-local composite state of the original wire fermions. Even though those original fundamental fermions you put into the theory, they are all heavy. But some strange non-local composite of the whole thing couples to the U1 photon, and that ruined the whole story. So the final answer, unfortunately, is negative, namely the zero-one model studied by Eric before really do not have a mirror sector that's entirely heavy. However, think of it positively, it does prove that the theory has a unitary continuum limit. So it does seem to at least numerically prove that the Ginsburg-Wilson formalism do have a unitary continuum limit, even when you introduce complicated Yukawa-type Murano-Yukawa-type couplings. Yeah, because we check all the unitarity bound is satisfied, everything else is satisfied, except we do find a light, single light massless fermion. Oh, okay, so at this point, everyone might be thinking, of course, it is bad because you study an anomalous theory. So what about anomaly-free models? Maybe this problem is nothing. And at least our study is also useful for simple models, simple-minded anomaly-free models. For example, if you just have three copies of isolated 0-1 model, and the whole thing, you satisfy the anomaly cancellation condition, but the theory has three isolated, separate copies, then any model like this is also going to be bad. Because if there is a light degree freedom in this sector, then that's the end of the story, right? Even though the whole thing may satisfy anomaly cancellation property, a condition is not going to save you, not going to help you at all. So most generally, we can conclude that if the theory had any anomalous global symmetry, that model will be SQ. And this is actually, in the end, not so surprising, because that's precisely what Thompson anomaly matching condition says. Essentially, if your theory has any anomalous global symmetry in the low energy limit, then it's going to be a light degree fermion. Okay? So that excludes all a huge class of candidate models.
Breaking of unitarity, in your case, you don't.
No. You don't break unitarity, but you, in the Ginsburg-Wilson formalism, what happens, you hit the singularity if you have completed dynamical gauge pattern. Eventually, if you vary the gauge, you eventually hit the singularity. However, we have not found evidence for breaking, for violation of unitarity. So in some sense, you shrink the range where the unitarity is violated into a singularity. Pictorially, that's what happened. Of course, for more involved model where you do break all the anomalous global symmetry by coupling all three copies together in a very complicated way, we don't have any convincing evidence that models like that won't work. Okay. And we should be able to do some numerical experiment on that, and we think it's quite doable because it's just going to be order one difference from what we have already done. So that's something we might want to do, we actually want to do in the near future. But at the same time, I think there's some analytic consideration might actually indeed lead to a proof that any model like this will not work. But I won't have time to go in later in this talk, which is actually this sector. This section, I was trying to tell you something, that there is a nice trick one might be able to do to prove that any model like this might actually not work. But this is something very preliminary, and I don't have a concrete. It's not been proven yet. I just have some idea. So I guess I'll skip over the entire section. So this is my summary of the. And at least I tried to tell you that Ginzburg-Wilson formalism is something theoretically appealing, quite elegant stuff, and it's very fun to think about, even though it's practically not very useful, as you said. We got more troubles than we in the end. But combining Ginzburg-Wilson formalism and idea of decoupling of neural fermion appeared, at least initially appeared, to make chiral escape theory possible. And some numerical simulation done by Jill and Eric was encouraging, but it was also kind of paradoxical. Using our splitting theorem, we examine the photon polarization operator more carefully. And at least numerically, we found there is, in fact, a light mirror in the mirror sector, a light fermion in the mirror sector. And the same study can exclude a large class of candidate models, where if the model has any anomalous focal symmetry, those models will be Q. So the open questions right now is this the end of the road, or maybe more complicated model can still survive? That is something we want to think about in the near future. And also at this point, I think I might have some idea about a general proof which might completely rule out these type of models. But this is only in progress, so maybe it's not true. So finally, the most interesting and challenging question in this field, at least to me, seems to be the non-abelian ones, because we don't even know if they exist or not. We don't even know non-abelian chiral landscape theory exists or not. Okay. And I think that's the most interesting question. Thank you for your attention.
So can we go back to the last stage of the second class? So I guess I just missed the part that what about the possibility that there may be system ghost in the light sector that cancel the light? Say for me, coming from the mirror sector. That is not a possibility.
What's that? Can you repeat?
I thought you mentioned a possibility where there may be some light fermion in the light sector that may be ghost, which cancels the light fermion.
In the zero world model, there's no ghost in the light sector. The light sector
that is known to be not a possibility.
No, it's very simple. It's just two masses, one from me.
I see. Yeah,
I don't think that goes on.
In your expression for the vacuum polarization, since I knew you, in QED, K-mu acting on primary mu is zero, the Bayesian variance.
Yes. If it's gauge invariance, primary mu is transversal. Precisely because this zero world model is a nonlinear.
Yeah, what happens here?
Yeah, because the zero world model
is
a the first part is zero. If you take that
right. Minus three A. If you take K mu, primary mu is good.
If you multiply this by K mu, that is zero because this is going to be K squared. And this is going to be
That's the transverse part.
Yeah.
What about
this piece? This piece is anomaly. Because
that's the anomaly.
Yeah, because the zero model is anomaly.
Yeah, because in standard QED that can
sure. If it's a normal free, if it's
a normal problem. Yeah. You take a continuum limit. You don't get standard QED. That's what's happening. This is what the problem is, right? You don't get gauge invariance.
Because I started with a zero one, which is anomalous. But the point is, what we have proven is, at least in the Ginzburg-Wilson formalism, the moment you have a massless, or the moment you have anomalies, automatically it means you have light fermions. Because the moment you have a number, this guy is not zero, then this lead has to be not zero, and you have a number.
And so you destroy the Gaussian invariance by having these like decreased.
That's right. In some
this
sense,
is not
right.
Good.
No, this is not good.
Can I have a picture though? I mean,
yeah.
It sounds like you're expecting the lattice to be different from the continuum in the state of that. The standard argument has been that if you have an anomaly, then if you were to have an anomalous sector which had all heavy degrees of freedom, you get a contradiction. Because if it was heavy, you can integrate it out, you get some local effective operator whose variation
is yes,
yes. But you know that anomaly.
That's right. That's the tough matching condition, basically.
And so that's what you're finding, right? That
yeah, that's what we're finding. But it was surprising to us because, as I told you before, unless this can be violated because there's a strong coupling symmetrical phase where you can integrate out everything and end up with nothing. But yeah,
but the thing is, the argument that says that's basically a locality argument, right? And that's something that isn't relying on Lorentz invariance. So why would you expect that to fail in the lattice? Because that's the thing that happens.
Well, okay, it's not that something we expected to fail. It's just something we didn't know whether it's true or not. Because on the lattice, this, as I told you, well, this Ginsberg-Russell formalism has all this weird stuff, as I said. Even if you have a nominal theory, you can still make sense if you confine yourself in a small gauge field region. You only get singularity when you have four dynamical gauge field. So when you confine yourself to a small gauge field region, the theory still makes sense. And it still seems to have linearity continuum limit at this point. So it's, yeah, the thing is we don't know which way is the, how the theory resolve this paradox. Either in the continuum limit, the theory might not become unitary, and then the same story you just said will not cover, right? The conclusion you just said. Or it keep unitarity, but somehow miraculously have a light degree fermion that you know match the continuum intuition. And it seems like what we find is the second possibility that seems to be at work.
It sounds like that you're confirming, so if someone had not done the work, then I agree that you need to do it to see, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're confirming what the naive picture was.
That's right. It seems like we're confirming the naive picture. But the reason we are very puzzled because in the early numerical works done by Jill and Mary, they have not found any light fermions. They do seem to find all the fermions are heavy. So that was the puzzle. We were very puzzled by that, and we were thinking maybe unitarity is early, or maybe Lorentz symmetry is wrong. We had a moment thought maybe exactly Lorentz symmetry has been violated in the continuum. So yeah, that's why we studied this because but so in the end we still find this is very very puzzling because what is this line from? We still haven't been able to pin down. We have some clue what this light fermion should be. It's some non-local object in terms of the original light fermions you put in the theory. But we still haven't completely understood. But yes, in the end, this seems like the naive to have anomaly matching condition is still correct in the case of
Ginsberg. Sorry, can I just re-ask that question? So if I start from an anomaly-free, let's say vector-like theory, where we know that there shouldn't be anything in IR that's, which naively I would not expect something non-local some non-local degree of freedom in the IR. That seems to suggest that sort of the non-local light degree of freedom that you see from the medial sector should be canceled from something in the light sector. I'm just still trying to re-ask the possibility that perhaps something from the light sector may cancel that.
I don't see how this can be.
But then you seem to be telling me that just suppose I consider the full theory, which is anomaly-free, as a vector-like theory, then I should expect something non-local in IR that is like.
Well, it's non-local in terms of the original field,
right.
In terms of the fundamental field.
Uh-huh.
But once you go to IR, you just look at single massless fermion. So it's not non-local, probably it's not a non-local
UFD.
So yeah, what I mean is, if you try to find what this degree of freedom is, in terms of the original wire fermion in the mirror sector,
okay.
You have to use some like 1 over D times some original funding. Okay. You have to use some local expression, like probably we are looking, thinking maybe something like this.
Is the size of the object? Is the size of the criticism at a scale of the cutoff, or can be far below the cutoff? I guess that's the relevant question.
This object?
Yeah. The
When you are far below the cutoff, it will just behave like a single nested spring. That seems to be what we find, although we don't quite know why.
Well,
I guess I still don't understand your question.
No, I'm saying you have some sort of, say, light particle in the theory. I'm trying to ask the size of the light particle on the order of the cutoff on the lattice, or is sort of some. That's something.
I think it's not. It's just single masses for now in the continuum.
And so what you write down on the board is the operator for creating the particle, or that's
true? Yeah, that's right. In terms of the original creation of the initial operator, you have to use this kind of logical operator to create it.
I see, that is a bound. Okay.
Yeah. It's not the theory about local in the IR.
Which seems to be something that's
Yes, a certain reason that point.
Because
it's not have you. To make a light one, you have to do something like
this. Okay, thanks. It is pretty logical.
Any further questions? All right, let's thank Yan Lun again.
Thank you.